From the Sky News Centre at 5, TV weather forecaster Fred Talbot has been found guilty of indecently assaulting two boys while working as a teacher in the 1970s. The attacks happened at a grammar school in Cheshire before he became famous on ITV's This Morning. During his police interview, Talbot was unwilling to answer questions about the allegations against him.
When did you start going on school trips?
No comment.
Do you remember your first school trip?
No comment.
Detective Constable Chris Doggart from Greater Manchester Police read a statement outside court.
He has accepted no responsibility for his crimes and forced his victims to relive their ordeal in open court decades after it happened. I hope they find some comfort and closure today.
Mr. Talbot will be sentenced next month. The British family of a prisoner in Guantanamo Bay has pleaded with the American government to send him home. Shaka Amar has been detained without trial inside the maximum security prison for 13 years. Almost a third of young people now say they're teetotal, up from a fifth 10 years ago. The number of young people who binge drink has also fallen. These students say they've definitely noticed people drinking less.
There is that sense that actually nowadays you don't actually have to drink to get involved.
I've done that myself and I've experienced that, you know, you don't actually have to drink to have a good time.
There has been a decrease in the drinking culture here. It's not what it was.
Campaigners say an apology from the publishers of the Daily Mirror over phone hacking is 4 years late. Hacked Off says the message published in today's paper doesn't mention effective press regulation or fair remedy for victims. Virgin Media's investment in UK broadband has been welcomed by David Cameron. The company is expanding its network over the next 5 years and creating 6,000 new jobs. That's the latest. I'm Simon English.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM
93.2. It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news, it's Labour councillor for St George West, Ron Stone. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, more on NATO's cop killers as we take a look at US declassified plans to overthrow Castro called Operation Northwoods. And more from Swiss professor Daniela Ganser, who's been studying NATO's secret armies for almost 20 years. And as the Cold War hots up, we hear from a musician who was commenting on the old Cold War back in the 1970s. What did John Lennon make of it all? Plus, CIA whistleblower Stephen D. Kelly says ISIS is a fabricated enemy and could be economically shut down tomorrow if NATO really wanted. So why haven't we seen Stephen D. Kelly on our TV screens? And is ISIS just a Trojan horse to get NATO troops into Syria by other means? Quiet regime change in Yemen. Not much media coverage of the unrest and coup over the last month or so. We'll hear about that. And today, Anonymous has what they call an Op Death Eaters rally in London, hoping to flush more child abusers out. But will the police really prosecute senior Tories and civil servants and even royals? Several survivors allege abuse took place in Buckingham Palace itself. In the run-up to a general election, we hear from abuse survivor Sam Hill. Plus, Martin Summers takes us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 5 Celsius and showers, highs of 9 Celsius this weekend, a fairly cloudy weekend with showers on Saturday. Next week, highs of 9, showers on Monday, but from Tuesday, a fairly sunny week. Next weekend, that's the 21st and 22nd of February, highs looking up, edging up a bit to 9 degrees, sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather broadcast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Labour councillor for St George West, Ron Stone. Hi, Ron, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello.
Give us an idea about what your portfolio is on the City Council. I know you were Deputy Labour Group Leader, I think, weren't you, up until recently?
Yeah, I mean, I've been deputy leader and leader by necessity at certain times.
Okay, so tell us about that. Well, why were you leader by necessity?
Well, Peter Hammond resigned, if you remember, over the issue of whether Labour had members in the cabinet.
Ah, I see. Right, yes. This is a sticky wicket, isn't it? Because, you know, what's your view on that? Should the Labour Party actually have... I mean, obviously, you've got a collective view, but what's your own view? Should the Labour Party be participating with George Ferguson in his cabinet?
I think we should have members in the cabinet. I don't think we should necessarily be participating with George with everything that he does and some of the candy floss things that he comes out with. And I think our cabinet members should be the scrutiny control over some of his more idiotic ideas that he's come out with in the last 18 months.
But I mean, there's a whole set of sort of scrutiny set on the council that does that, is supposed to do it anyway, isn't there? Why have someone doing that in the cabinet too?
Well, the problem is, yes, we've got a scrutiny structure, but if 70 councillors, including the cabinet members, decide that something that George is doing is completely wrong and completely mad, and we all vote against it, the law has given George the power to say, I hear what you say, but I'm going to do it anyway.
But that's
that sounds modern democracy.
That sounds like more like a dictatorship.
It is, totally, which is why I say, before some of the idiotic ideas see the light of day, our members in the cabinet should be putting a control on it.
So give us an idea of what, you know, in your words, these latest idiotic ideas are.
All right, I will. Quite simple. Bristol Green Capital. Green Capital Year, right? And we got the idiot who wanted to put pianos in the local park. And when he did, I told him not to do it. And it ended up being set on fire. It burnt out a third of the wiring to the lighting in the park and took months to restore. It stopped the aerator in the lake, and the fish in the lake started to die.
Now, hang on. How does a fire in a piano get into the lake and stop the aerator?
Because it melted all the wires at the main junction box.
Oh, I see, okay.
It was chained to it. Now, the latest one, same idiot that put the slide down Park Street, is now saying he wants to put fishing boats in Lee Woods in the middle of a nature conservation area in a green year and invite 430,000 people of Bristol to trample all over the flora and fauna.
But hang on, I mean, the slide went down quite well, didn't it? The Park Street slide.
Well, all I can say is it totally disrupted the hospital and traffic past it and people trying to get to the hospital. So, you know, you can have an argument about that. But I think putting fishing boats to raise your awareness and people in this city of rising tide levels by trampling all over some of the most rare plants in the world that are in Lee Woods is totally crazy, particularly in a green capital, in a green capital year.
I mean, this sort of stuff will only be allowed to happen if we don't have a healthy press locally, and that when ideas start, that they don't get a criticism in the press. A lot of the, particularly the Bristol Post, is quite eulogises George. In fact, I mean, many people say it's part of his election campaign, is the newspaper.
Well, they were.
What's your thoughts about the health of the Bristol press?
Well, I think it's extremely sick at the minute.
So we've got ITV, BBC, we've got the Bristol Post, we've got a few others, haven't we? Give us your view of each of those three anyway.
Well, if you look, for example, at the coverage of the Post at the last council meeting that we had, Ian Onions turned up. He waited for one issue that was on the agenda. There was others that were equally as important and probably more expensive, and he left. And there was no report of the rest of the council for people that wanted to buy the Post.
Well, just for the record, I mean, I've left several messages on Ian Onions' answer phone asking him if he'd like to come on this programme to talk about his view of the politics of the city. He never got a single reply. So that's the Bristol Post. What about ITV and BBC?
Well, ITV and BBC, I think as a councillor, and I've been here, as you know, 30 years now, I think they actually accept me as somebody that, one, is prepared to come and talk on something, even if it's uncomfortable. two to get an honest answer. But basically, what I tend to find is that whatever is the issue, they've got their own personal agenda and they've already decided how they want to style the programme. And so if you give an answer that's not right in their eyes, they will try to skew what you're saying or get you to repeat something or to get yourself into a situation where you're forced to agree with them. And I'm afraid in 30 years I've never done that.
Okay. Now, an extract I'm going to give you, just because this is a little bit of paper I've had hanging around for a few weeks, but as an extract now from a book, J. Arthur Gibbs, A Cotswold Village, Country Life and Pursuits in Gloucestershire. It was written over 100 years ago, before the age of television, before there was any BBC or ITV, but it's very relevant, I think. It says, the press is every day becoming more and more powerful for good or evil. Its influence on men's minds has become so marked that it may with truth be said that the press rules public opinion, rather than the public opinion ruling the press. How do we get to the stage, do you think, when actually the press starts to just reflect? Like, I mean, the Mirror, isn't it? That's one of the ways that the Mirror got its name. Reflects public opinion rather than tries to lead it, Ron.
Yeah, well, absolutely. But I'm afraid you'll find that the backers of local or even national newspapers pull the strings. And so instead of being able to be, if you like, an honest periodical or newspaper that attempts to put people's views forward in an honest manner, you end up with somebody that says, you can't say that because that's against my interests. And so money is behind the whole of the press and publicity machine that we've got, and that will style and, if you like, plan how they present the news.
Well, we had Chris Brown on here. He's the editor, was the editor of Bristol 24/7. He's a former, I think he was a chief sub at the Western Daily Press, and he took redundancy from Northcliffe, as it was at the time, the Daily Mail that owned the old Evening Post, and now it's another organisation which has got a lot of Daily Mail representation, but it's not called the Daily Mail or Northcliffe anymore. And he's no longer the editor there. A chap called Mike Bennett and Dougal Templeton are now running the show. So, you know, that's another organisation that he started it, created it, etc. And now it's being run by people who are much closer to the corporate rulers of the city, you know, these sort of merchant venturer types. So we're not going to be getting the same kind of coverage, and actually very independent-minded coverage that Chris Brown used to give on Bristol 24/7. But there is some light at the end of the tunnel, and it's called the Bristol Cable. One of those little things. It's a website, and it's also a newspaper. If you haven't got a copy yet, it's just out the end of this week, the second edition of this new newspaper, and you'll be able to get it round Stokes Croft, because that's where they're based, and there'll be, I'm sure, if you actually, after chasing down a copy of it, you'll find one there. And I spoke to one of the writers for Bristol Cable, Adam Cantwell Corn, about what's in their second edition.
My name's Adam. I'm a member of the Bristol Cable and journalist and organiser with it. And basically, we're a new magazine, cooperatively owned and produced in the city, investigating different features and bringing different voices and local ideas to the forefront, and trying to provide a real and direct alternative to the boring and unengaging corporate press.
Okay, tell us what's in this new edition.
We've got an interview with Governor of HMP Bristol and a former prisoner and now prison reformer, discussing, is the prison system in crisis? We've got a piece, there's a round table of several women from Bristol talking about responses to sexual violence and everyday sexism. We've got a piece on housing and the rise of luxury student accommodation as compared to the dire state of the rental market and increasing prices. And we've also got a range of infographics and illustrations to accompany a lot of these pieces.
Now, I noticed in your first edition you had quite an interesting piece about who actually owns the Bristol Post. Yeah. So what makes you different?
Well, right now, one thing is that we're amateurs, we're citizen journalists. At the moment, nobody really involved has professional media experience, and we're directly owned and created by people in Bristol. So you can become a member for as little as £1 a month, and then you will have direct say over how we produce it and our strategy. And our first real strategy meeting with everybody involved as a co-op member is going to be on the 5th of March, our annual general members meeting for the first time next month. month.
Well, it sounds almost like the way that the original Bristol Post was started back in the 1920s and the 1930s, because you know, there were Bristol people saying, well, actually, we don't want these big companies that at the time it was the Daily Mail dominating the local press.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's true, and I think hopefully we're seeing a bit of a fight back against the standard, either boring or conservative, local and national newspapers, and with alternatives that also move beyond your comment-based blogs or citizen journalism that doesn't really have an organised platform. And we're trying to bring an organisational element to the power of citizen journalism by having a publication, by having an editorial process, by having a print edition every 2 months that we get out all across the city, as well as multimedia content online.
Adam Cantwell Corn there from the Bristol Cable. If you want a copy of that, well, you can go online and read it, obviously, but you can actually get a paper copy around Stokes Croft and other places around, generally around the city centre at the moment, because it's only just literally been printed. Anyway, what's your thoughts, Ron, about this idea of kind of cooperative newspaper with young people, most of them in their early 20s, writing it, even though they're should we say amateurs, they were saying there, actually quite a lot of what they're writing is as good, even better than some of the professional journalists in the city.
Well, I think it's a great idea, and obviously some of those contributors will become professional journalists and probably be on major TV networks or radio networks within probably the next 10 to 15 years. And if they haven't got an ability to be able to practice and learn their trade, that's very sad, and you know, good luck to them, and as far as I'm concerned.
Well, let's hope they don't have to learn by being sued.
Well, I hope not, no.
I'm also joined by Belinda Faulks. Hi, Belinda, welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, thank you very much.
Belinda, you've been involved in this Rising Up campaign up at Stapleton Allotments. Do you just want to just tell us the background as to why you think this is an important campaign? So it's been in the news this week again. The City Council has got a possession order to get rid of the protest camp that's now up there.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I think there's lots of different issues that are really important connected to this campaign. I mean, the big one is really the damage and destruction to incredibly valuable green spaces. I mean, the part of the metro bus route that we're really objecting to, although we do have objections to some of the general facts about Metrobus, but the main part is this M32 bus only junction, which is going to be damaging greenbelt, a conservation area, woodland, wildlife corridor and habitat, high grade agricultural land, as well as Stoke Park as well. It'll impact upon
this is a sort of a pie in the face really for Bristol Green Capital, since this Metrobus scheme is actually encroaching on so much green space. How many different areas of green space are being encroached by this scheme?
Do you mean across the whole
across the
of
city.
The three routes? I believe there's at least about 28 different green spaces. Some of them also have status of kind of ancient woodland, as well as kind of meadows, of kind of wildlife habitat, various different places. I believe the Alliance to Rethink Metrobus came up with a green capital calendar, which stated quite a lot of those as well, with kind of pictures.
Well, the closest most of us ever get to Stapleton Allotments and the small holdings there is just driving up and down the M32, Belinda. So just tell us what goes on there. It's a little bit of land just on the right hand side as you're heading off out of the city, but what's going on at the moment? You know, obviously there's protest at the moment, but
sure.
But why what happens there? Because it's quite open to the public, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's described by a lot of people as kind of a little piece of paradise, because you wouldn't notice it. It is right near the M32 and just off Stoke Lane and French Park Road, which is quite a busy area for lots of traffic. But when you enter this area, it's absolutely beautiful. It's green, it's open, it's full of wildlife, it's full of birds, but then it also has the kind of social aspect to it, as in there are allotments, so they're long-standing allotments. I mean, you've got allotment holders that are going to be losing plots that they've had for 30 years and their parents had before that for 30 years. So this is kind of intergenerational plots that are being lost.
Yeah, and small holdings
relocated. And the small holdings.
I didn't even know we had small holdings.
Yeah, so the
Bristol.
Small holdings. So we had a visit on the Action campsite last week from the small holding a person who had a small holding there up until about a year and a half ago, when he was kicked off to make way for the metro bus to come through. And he'd had it for 40 years. And he came to show his support and thanks to us as well. And he'd been there with animals and hoped to pass it on to his daughter, but unfortunately wasn't allowed. So you've got the small holdings, and some of those small holdings have been leased to Avon Wildlife Trust, who have managed the Feed Bristol project for the last 3 years on that site. Feed Bristol will be remaining on some of the land there. Not all of the land is being developed upon, but the land directly adjacent to the land that Feed Bristol are on and did have leased up until just recently will be absolutely destroyed if this development goes ahead.
Now
Feed Bristol is an amazing
project.
But
hang on, we've got £200 million this whole thing is going to cost, and it's climbing. The actual amount is climbing.
They're escalating.
Now, why on earth can't the council, and I'm going to ask you this, Ron, why can't the council and the government actually pay out of that £200 million, maybe a little bit, for the field next door, which is a cow grazing in it, rather than this really important site, which people from right across the city use, and a lot of local people are using it directly with allotments. So what on earth's going on here? They've decided, it seems to me, that they can't be bothered with purchasing the field next to it, or because this site that Belinda's talking about is actually council owned. So the easiest thing is just to ride railroad over the people who are already using it. That's us.
I understand that. And what I'd say is, I think the current site's totally the wrong location for what they're trying to do. I think the reason for picking that site is the very one that you've just mentioned, and that is the council already owns the land, and therefore they wouldn't have to find some means of funding to buy an adjacent plot or another set of plots. And you may be able to tell me better, but I understood the allotment land, when it's declared allotment land, was passed through the House of Lords yonks ago. And if you want to change it, sell it off, or do something different with it, you had to get something through a bill through the House of Lords to do it. Now, whether that's happened, I suspect it has. Yep. But I think the issue is that the council is too mean to put its hand in its pocket and do the right thing and the decent thing at the minute.
So just to respond to that, yeah, you're correct. It is normal. Allotment land is protected by the Allotment Act 1925.
That's what I
because
thought.
It's supposed to be for people, the people, to grow food on and not tarmac over for commuter buses. But what they did was they got permission, or consent from the Secretary of State in 2013, whilst telling him the usual metro bus story of how this is a glorious sustainable transport system that's going to solve all the transport problems in Bristol, and this piece of land is key to that, which I think is a big kind of untruth that's being put forward, that they can't actually have a scheme without this bus only junction which comes off the motorway. So they were given permission. They were actually given permission on some of it was false information as well. They didn't actually provide the true information about the quality of the agricultural land there, which has really high grade soil, a mixture of 1 to 3, best and most versatile, which is in planning policy is advised to against developing on that if there are other options available.
Well, look, so just to be clear, happened. I asked Mark Bradshaw onto this programme to explain, because he's got the transport portfolio. He's one of your colleagues in the Labour group. He's on the cabinet with George Ferguson, and his phone's been switched off for the last few days, and that's because he's in Japan just as all this is happening, which is a great pity, because it's part of his portfolio and it's probably the most controversial part of it. But Belinda, what is happening? Because you've got you've just had this possession order against the protest camp that's now on up there. So are you calling on people around Bristol to do?
Well, we're calling on people to still support the campaign. I mean, the campaign's happening on lots of different levels. There's the kind of direct on the ground people still at the camp. People feel so strongly about this, and they realise that this possession order has been kind of now served against persons unknown who are on the land. Although two of us did actually go to court and name ourselves as as defendants and had to face the QC for Burgess Salmon, who are sponsors of the Green Capital. And the, one of the reasons they actually got this possession order done so quickly, one of the reasons was the urgency for Metrobus to actually go ahead, and also because they were worried we were damaging the land, which I just found, I did point out to them that we were actually looking after the land and there to care for it and there to protect it, and the damage that they're actually intending to do and the reason they want to get us off there might actually be more serious than what we're actually doing there at the moment, which they kind of seem to miss that point.
Belinda, it may be this might be the last weekend that people can actually go and visit the site.
I would really say get yourself there. I mean, don't, you know, we don't want people to put themselves in a dangerous situation. We're not asking people to kind of front up to, you know, the bailiffs if they come in, because that is what is anticipated, some type of eviction. But we would call for support, and we would call for numbers, and we would call for people to be there to witness this taking place, and actually take part in that and to stand up and show that they support, you know, the people that are there or that have been there and a lot of the issues that are behind it, and just that they show that they care.
And take your cameras, folks. Get a picture of this beautiful bit of Bristol before it goes.
Go up there. We've no idea what's going to happen. I mean, there's people still up in the trees, you know, and these people, they're not going to, you know, resist violently. You know, people are there to be peaceful, but they're not actually just willing to roll over and let this happen. There's been such a clash when they talk about a democratic process on many different instances.
So look, Ron, this is really terrible, isn't it, to be happening as Bristol is announcing, and Mayor Ferguson is announcing his green capital, one of the most important green spaces in the city, is just trashed.
Yeah, absolutely. Some years now, I must be 5 years ago now, I had to chair the commission, if you wanted to call that, on parks and green spaces. And at that time, all the green spaces other than the central parks were under threat.
And that was Gary Hopkins' little plan.
I know, I put around a large brick in his pond on that one. And so Duchess Pond in Duchess Park, which is adjacent, etc., we had battles over that. And then there's the other wood in and the woodland as well that people had to fight like mad to save. And I think it's extremely tragic, and it's a total contradiction in the, like I say, candy floss headlines that George loves in relation to being a green capital proud of it. And yet this is totally alien to that agenda. It's crazy.
It sounds two-faced to me. Why can't they just buy the field next door and put it there instead? Then we don't have to trash these allotments and small holdings.
Can I just say as well, so that there's been various kind of possibilities or alternatives suggested. The major one that has been suggested and put forward as being the most logical conclusion to this, or logical alternative, would be use Junction 1. That would not involve any development. The M32 is seen as a kind of showcase bus route that's, you know, showcased by the council for being this fantastic bus route. And Junction 1 would enable buses to go up the up to Junction 1, turn left. They could go along the Filton Road into the UE through the back entrance, because this is all about the buses getting to the University of West England. And so what they could do is go straight up to Junction 1, turn off, get into UE the back way, which is the way a lot of the buses go in now anyway, and then off into the north fringe of Bristol from there. That has just been pushed aside. They say it's not possible. They come up with some general reasons why this is not possible, but they cannot and will not provide concrete evidence that they have done detailed designs and analyses and assessments to show that this is not possible, because they haven't done it.
Okay, Belinda, just remind listeners whereabouts this is, if people want to go and have their last look this weekend or go up and support.
Yeah, so it's on the corner of Frenchay Park Road and Stoke Lane, parallel to the M32. This is in Stapleton, kind of Frenchay border. The main entrance to the site that we're on at the moment is actually on Frenchay Park Road. It's not on the Stapleton allotments entrance, which is up Stoke Lane. So you enter from Frenchay Park Road a little bit further down from Feed Bristol. We're not part of Feed Bristol. What we're doing isn't connected to Feed Bristol. It's partly there because of the concerns that we have for that project, but we're not actually occupying the land that Feed Bristol are leasing, and they're not supporting us practically in any way to do that either.
Okay. Belinda Faulks from Rising Up, thanks ever so much for joining us today. Also, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, got to bring you in on this. This is being touted as a great sort of, it's almost like a mini version of the HS2, you know, here in Bristol, some kind of high-tech transport system. It's really difficult to I don't think it's going to be a massive relief of transport. A lot of it is being brought in for the new development that's going on in Filton. That's one of the big reasons this is happening. How can they just run roughshod over what local people actually really want? We're supposed to have had the Localism Act, for example, with this government, aren't we?
Well, I mean, in actual fact, the way planning law works in Britain, if you've got to actually prove that something really is detrimental before it can be stopped. The general principle is that things go ahead unless there's a reason not to. If you think back to the Industrial Revolution, that's the sort of way that Britain has been run for many, many decades. But I mean, we're always trying short run fixes for long run problems, and you can't solve we've got to where we are now through having an emphasis on motor cars and motor transport going back decades, and just putting a bus in as opposed to having people in cars. You've still got all the traffic on the roads. There's still the bottlenecks with the buses have got to get
somewhere down the line. One of the planners has said, well, here's a nice easy to use bit of land because the council own it. We're not going to bother putting whatever it is, £10,000 or something, maybe £20,000, a bit more in the budget to buy another field because we already own this. And there doesn't seem to be any compensation for the people, the ordinary people like us, that lose an amenity here.
Well, I mean, we need to rethink. I mean, if you remember, Tony, you've seen pictures of Bristol's transport in the 1950s, and there were much less cars on the road, and the local buses company was owned by the municipality, and things were actually pretty efficient. And we've moved away from that over the years, and we've got ourselves into a mess where lots of vested interests. So you mentioned the Filton development, something that perhaps should be an airport being turned into a housing development, and then of course there are knock-on implications for traffic. But this kind of development without thought and without proper planning is the market, if you like, at work, and it usually comes up with dog's breakfast.
Yeah, well, this certainly looks like that. Talking of dog's breakfast, there's the HSBC scandal this week by a whistleblower, and a lot of investigative journalists turning that out at the beginning of the week, and it was mentioned several times by Ed Miliband, the Labour leader, leader of the opposition, and David Cameron at Prime Minister's Questions.
Mr. Speaker, an hour ago we learnt that linked to the HSBC tax avoidance scandal are seven Tory donors, including a former treasurer of the Tory party, who between them have given nearly £5 million to the Conservative Party. How can the Prime Minister explain the revolving door between Tory party HQ and the Swiss branch of HSBC?
I saw this list just before coming to Prime Minister's Questions, and one of the people named is the Labour donor Lord Paul, who funded Gordon Brown's election campaign. I am very clear. People should pay their taxes in our country, and no government has been tougher than this one in chasing down tax evasion and tax avoidance.
Well, that was Prime Minister's Questions. Martin Summers, there's obviously fingers being pointed at Labour too. Tax evasion, tax avoidance, whatever you want to call it. It was in HSBC over in Switzerland.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's been a general tolerance for this kind of corporate misbehaviour going back for decades. And I think it's very important that people are reminded of the way the world really works and what really goes on. And no doubt, of course, the Labour front bench wants to stick it all on the Tories, but they're not the only culprits, as you rightly pointed out.
Ron, the problem here seems to be that the banks that cheat the most actually do the best, and they are kind of stealing a march on the other banks.
Well, yeah, it's not only that. The bankers that got this country into a complete mess by lying to governments of all colours right across the world are the people that came out of it best of all. Because not only did they fail, did they lie, but they got golden handshake. And they must be laughing all the way to their tax haven in the Seychelles.
Now, I mean, looking at the list of people that was the whistleblowers came up, one of them is the Queen's cousin, Prince Michael of Kent. He had a company as part of this HSBC over in Switzerland. The government's missed hundreds of millions of pounds of tax through these individuals that have kept their money there, but it's not illegal, is it?
No, which is what Lord Fink said when he was questioned about it. He said he was going to...
this is the Conservative Party treasurer.
He said he was going to sue Ed Miliband for accusing him of tax evasion, and then presumably had a word with his lawyers and realised that that was not really a viable thing to do because he was evading tax. Now, Lord Fink could say, well, it's not illegal, but I would say to Lord Fink, but you're a public figure. You are running for public office and your party is running for public office, and you've got to be squeaky clean. And it's all very well saying, but I don't have to be squeaky clean. Said, no, you don't. But the electorate will draw its own conclusions from that. The idea, and of course, the super wealthy, one of the things he said was very revealing. Everybody avoids tax, he said. Now, most people in this country are actually on PAYE. So they pay their tax out of their pay packets before they even see their pay packets. They don't avoid tax.
I suppose it's only when you've got maybe 30,000, 40,000, 100,000, a million in the bank that you start thinking, well, I don't want to leave it in the bank because it's getting taxed there.
Indeed.
I'm going to stick it offshore.
Indeed, but it just shows the world they live in that when he says everybody avoids tax, and no doubt many senior Labour politicians will have tax advice and so on and so forth. But of course, we've got to change the culture and change the rules. I mean, the banking system has been bailed out by the taxpayer, and at that point, in fact, the Riot Act should have been read to them. It wasn't, and we're now actually on the verge of a further crash.
Well, I hate to point
next
it out,
time we are going to read the
Labour Party's
action.
Fault, Martin. Anyway, General, you're talking about the world they live in. General election paying £15,000 a table. Just who are the donors funding the Tories' election campaign? That's this week. The black and white ball run by the Conservatives. To raise money for the general election. The embossed invitations began dropping through the letterboxes of some of the richest men and women in Britain back in October. Bordered with the outlines of the red, white and blue Union flag, thick card requested the pleasure of their company at the Conservatives' black and white election fundraiser. But the accompanying literature made it clear it was less the pleasure of their company the Tories were requesting, and more the pleasure of their wallets. Ron, what do you think about this sort of event? Because the Labour Party surely does fundraisers too.
Yes, they do. However, I think it reflects a little better on the Labour Party. It is a way of raising money, but we don't charge £15,000 a table.
Okay, how much does the Labour Party charge?
£60.
£60, what, is that to sit around the table with Ed Miliband?
Yes, or whoever happens to be available on the circuit to come to whatever area of the country. Can I say that I already contribute... quite a lot of money to the Labour Party because as a councillor I get an allowance for being chair of licensing, and that is top sliced in relation to paying for Labour campaigns in any election. And so I don't see the reason why I should need to pay another £60 to go and have probably a dodgy meal. And dodgy's a good word this week, isn't it? And to rub shoulders with Ed Balls, because last time he came to Bristol and I met him on the street, I talked to him for 2 minutes, turned round and he disappeared. And it took me half an hour to find where he'd gone. And so, as far as I'm concerned, they are an event. Some of it is possibly interested to the local press and media, but I personally have got better things to spend £50-60 on.
Okay, one of the lists as part of the coverage of this looks at some of the Tory donors and hedge fund money, because there's a lot of hedge funds seem to just basically fund the Tory party, Martin.
Yep.
We've got Michael Farmer from RK Capital Management, £6.5 million. Sir Michael Hintz from CQS, £3.2 million. Lord Fink, £3.2 million. From ISAM, that's the former Tory treasurer. Chris Rokos from Brevan Howard, £1.3 million. There's a whole list here. None of these people, I think, actually have I ever heard of, and yet the actual total amount here must be something like, oh gosh, £15-20 million donations from mostly almost all hedge fund managers.
Indeed, I mean, Lord Fink has obviously got £3 million to spare for his political causes. The Labour Party still struggles to fund itself via the trade unions. And, a £3 million would be a big slice of money from the trade unions. And Lord Fink's just given it in one go as a personal donation. But on the other hand, the real problem with money in politics is, A, we've bailed out the financial services sector. They then use the profits they've made from the bailout, because without the bailout there would have been no profit, to buy the political process and ask for more. And that's the thing that Ed Miliband is trying to draw attention of the electorate to. The Tories are funded by financial services industry, and they carry out their policies in to satisfy the financial services.
Well, this whole business of the HSBC tax avoidance evasion, I mean, certainly some criminal charges have been brought, and that's obviously tax evasion. Just to remind folks that the Cameron family fortune was made in tax havens, and his father Ian was a pioneer of offshoring people's money so they didn't have to pay tax on it, and that was revealed in The Guardian on Friday the 20th of April 2012. He built up a legal offshore funds in Panama and Geneva, did Ian Cameron. So the family money that was made on the back of this whole thing from the end of exchange controls at the beginning of the 1980s under the Thatcher government, that meant that people could move their money suddenly around the world wherever they wanted, and they moved it with the help of Ian Cameron.
Yes, indeed, and I understand that Samantha Cameron's family are involved in the same scam. The fact is that this is what's happened over the time, is that the ruling class in Britain has become increasingly financialised and married into the financial markets, literally and physically. And the real turning point for this should have been 2008, when governments all over the world were forced to bail out the financial services sector. And don't forget, we're talking about British financial services sector. It's got interests all over the world, so it wasn't nothing to do with Britain's interests. It was their international interests that were bailed out. And at that point, the Riot Act should have been read. It wasn't read by Labour, and it certainly hasn't been read by the Coalition. But we're on the verge now of a further crash. I'm absolutely confident we're going to have a further crash, and when we have that, I don't want any more excuses from the rich boys at the top table. We're going to demand our money back.
Ron, David Cameron's father, Ian, was instrumental in setting up a Panamanian company called, ironically, Blairmore Holdings in 1982, which was exempt from UK tax when David was a mere 16-year-old pupil at Eton.
Yeah, absolutely, and probably the non-paid tax for that paid for his school fees, I assume. Privilege and money buys you the ability to manipulate power and to buy, if you like, the ear of government. And it's very difficult to break that circle, but I'm afraid we're stuck with it. And until we get enough steel in a government that can actually do something like Martin's have been outlining, I think we're going to suffer this for a lot longer. And like him, with the question mark in relation to, are we out of the recession or are we going to go into another one because of prices and everything else, I think the market is very delicate, and I think we might very well be on the brink of something really bad.
Well, I mean, a lot of what the HSBC have been up to, with Lord Green particularly, who was made a government minister, who was the chairman of HSBC at the time, is people have been calling for prosecutions of these individuals who were running these businesses where this tax evasion was going on, and it's simply not happened. Anyway, Anne McKilding asked a question about this at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday.
In November 2012, HMRC, in evidence to the Public Accounts Committee, said there were a dozen prosecutions in train in relation to the HSBC caseload. None of them have come to court yet. Can he explain to us why that is the case?
Prime Minister.
Well, first of all, on prosecutions for tax evasion, the figures are they've actually gone up fivefold under this government since 2010. 2,650 cases, leading to hundreds of years of imprisonment taken as a whole. That's what's happened. But there is an important point here, which is in our country, the Tax Collection Agency, HMRC, is independent of government, independent of ministers, and it has to raise the taxes and carry out the investigations and order the prosecutions. And it's very important in a free country that ministers are not given the details of who is being investigated and what the prosecutions are. Now, this doesn't happen in other countries, and we have a word for it. It's called corruption. But it seems to be the path suggested by the party opposite.
That's David Cameron answering the question about the 12 impending, back in 2012, prosecutions of HSBC people, and none of which has happened, Ron. So why is this? I mean, does it seem that these people seem to be immune from prosecution, some sort of impunity?
Well, I think you may have answered that question earlier in relation to donations.
Ah, yes, good point.
In relation to the ability to buy, if you like.
But David Cameron
decisions.
There, Martin, was saying that the ministers shouldn't get involved with any specific cases.
No, but what he's saying is that ministers shouldn't have inside information about prosecutions. I agree with that. We should all know who's actually being prosecuted. When somebody's arrested for, you know, possession of cannabis or whatever it is, their name goes in the paper. And the same should happen for people who are being brought to court for tax fraud.
Okay, on the bigger picture, Bank of England boss Mark Carney has issued negative inflation warning to George Osborne. Martin, what is this negative inflation? Deflation?
Deflation is negative inflation. Well, what they're worried about is we haven't really had deflation since the 1930s, and it's falling prices, which we probably haven't experienced even in Ron's lifetime, never mind mine. And but that sounds like a good idea. Prices are falling, everything's cheaper. But the problem is it becomes very difficult to make capitalism work in a period of deflation, because it's a self-reinforcing cycle. It's basically slump. And that's what they're struggling with in the Eurozone, which is pretty. And of course, everybody's trying to export their deflation to everybody else.
Is this just simply a product of the fact that people don't have as much money to spend?
Well,
anymore.
Quite, yes.
And so companies are just having to say, well, we're not going to sell any of these widgets unless
that's
we
right.
put the price down.
So what happens then is confidence in the pound falls and shares fall. And then we're into another
side. But the figures are still looking quite good. We're just about in growth, aren't we?
Yeah, but I think we're on the edge of what's capable.
We're
on the precipice of a turn here. And if you look at the British financial services sector doesn't just deal with Britain. I mean, even the Icelandic financial services sector didn't just deal with Iceland. And I'm afraid things that are happening in Greece and the Ukraine and Brazil and China are far more important even than the idiotic policies pursued by the current coalition government.
The other thing is Mark Carney,
you know,
Martin,
we're at the heart of the financial system.
Mark Carney,
when it goes down, we'll be
talking about printing more money, the old counterfeiter that he is, and expanding the 375
that's called quantitative easing.
Billion money printing policy known as quantitative easing to be expanded.
Yeah, well, the problem with quantitative easing is beyond a certain point, it doesn't work. Come back to our widget producer earlier. You could say, well, if there's quantitative easing, that puts more money in the pockets of the banks and they should lend it out to businesses and so on. But ultimately, money printing is not very effective against deflation. What you've actually got to do is the government, local or national, has got to say, we are going to do X, Y, and Z, and we are going to support the level of demand in the economy. And I just read an article about this earlier in the London Review of Books. The idea that monetary policy on its own can rescue the economy used to be regarded as a silly idea. But we're not allowed, the government's not allowed to do things. What we really need across Europe is what Syriza is saying, is we need to invest in people, we need to invest in new infrastructure, and the government needs to take the lead. Possibly by raising taxes on the wealthy, because that's where all the money is. It hasn't disappeared to Mars. It's all in the Cayman Islands sitting there.
I mean, for example, in Iceland, they've raised the amount people are getting on social security so that they can spend more.
That's what you do in a crisis. You don't, when you're going to put people on the dole because there's a shock, you say, right, but we're going to increase the dole to make sure the shock is less than it would otherwise be. Well, a welfare state is not an optional add-on in a modern capitalist economy. It's an absolutely essential
thing. The government are arguing, Peter Lilly specifically at Prime Minister's Questions, that there are actually 2 million new private sector job, so let's have a listen to him.
Mr. Peter Lilly!
Given the widespread cynicism about politicians' promises and claims, will my right honourable friend remind people, however long it takes, that this government has presided over the creation of more than 2 million additional private sector jobs, which is far, far more than than we ever promised. And doesn't that discredit the claims of the opposition that our efforts to cut the deficit would destroy jobs?
My honourable friend is absolutely right. The figures are clear. We have created 2 million additional private sector jobs, and if you look at the extra number of people in work, public and private sector combined, it is 1.75 million more people. Now, behind those statistics are families who've now got a pay packet and a job and the chance to have a more secure future. And all of this at a time when the leader of the opposition was very clear. He warned that our policies would cost 1 million jobs. He was 1,000,000% wrong. And it's time they withdrew what they said and apologised for all those statements.
Well, in relation to that, I would ask what jobs have been created, at what level, and at what pay level are they, and what jobs have we lost? What we've seen under Peter Lilly's party is the complete decimation of Britain as a manufacturing country. We've seen all our steel, shipbuilding, car build, even the planes are hanging on by their fingernails. And the jobs that have been created are, if you like, very low tech and probably very low paid. And it's not one for one. And we are a net importer under the Tories. We're not a net exporter that we should be. And British industry has been torn to pieces by the Tories. And we have not got that manufacturing base that we had 30 years ago when I first left school and started working.
Well, I mean, can I just pick up on what's a rather minor point? When the Prime Minister said he's 1,000,000% wrong, I resent people using percentages in that way. It's a silly kind of way to talk about things. You know, you can't have 1,000,000% of anything. Sorry, I've been working in an infant school recently. Rubbing off on me. Now, coming back to the substantial point, the stagnation in the economy, which the Chancellor caused himself. The economy was growing, the jobs were being created, and he slammed on the anchors of austerity as they came to power. Then there was a period of nothing much happening as he attempted to reduce the deficit. Then as the election came into view and he realised that nothing was happening, he took his foot off the brake and gradually the economy started to pick up. It's like banging your head on a brick wall. It's nice when you stop. But the reason why we've got more very, very low quality jobs, as Ron has pointed out, is because in actual fact the deficit hasn't come down according to the schedule that he originally laid out. In actual fact, we're pretty much by accident pretty much where we might have been anyway had there been a Labour government, but without the 2 years of austerity at the beginning of the coalition's rule. But I mean, we're talking here about managing how to drive the car. And people still don't get this. The deficit is not the major problem. The deficit is a symptom of the fact that the international capitalist system is actually shot to pieces. You cut, when you've got you've had a million, so he says 2 million jobs, but we've had zero interest rates and quantitative easing for 5 years. That's not a normal result. That's totally dependent upon keeping on jacking up the crack. And, of course, they're running out of crack. And at some point, everything's going to crack up.
Well, most people on the sort of lower half of the income brackets who are working aren't actually getting enough money to pay the bills, etc., the rent, and that kind of thing. And so benefits are really important. And what's been also happening, of course, is that benefit sanctions have been kicking in for the unemployed, where people have actually no money at all. Well, it's not the end of that. If Labour get in, according to Rachel Reeves, who's the Shadow Work and Pensions Secretary, she's calling Ron to stop any kind of dole payments after 2 years, and that will force the jobless to take any work, however low paid.
Well, can I say I wouldn't support that, and I would do everything inside the Labour Party to make sure that that didn't happen, because I think that is absolutely the wrong way to go. And if you look at, as Martin has said, the people at the lowest end of the earning circle, and as you pointed out, the benefits and issues that go with that, and then you add into the agenda the bedroom tax. They're probably in a council house, maybe the family's moved out and they're now facing evictions, etc. The only target that the current Tory government has are anybody other than their mates and the people at the bottom. And I think the worst element came out about 2 weeks ago when the Independent Living Fund was going to be withdrawn. These are people with severe learning and physical disabilities that want to remain independent in their home, and they're going to be able to struggle to be able to do that. And that is criminal in my view.
Well, just to, well, before we move off from the unemployed, latest figures show the number of people claiming Job Seekers Allowance stood at 867,700 in December, down from 1.6 million in 2011, but still 90,000 higher than in the pre-crash trough in February 2008. So actually there's still more people claiming JSA than before the 2008 bailout, Martin.
Well, that's right. That's the reality of the situation. So,
despite these 2 million jobs that have popped out of nowhere,
yes, because we lost a lot of jobs in the crash.
But Ron's brought in a really important point, which is things like benefits for the sick and disabled, and that was also brought up at Prime Minister's Questions.
Mr. Peter Hain.
The Motability car that my severely disabled constituent Mark Francis has had for 11 years is being taken from him in 2 weeks. Born with hereditary spastic paraplegia, unable to walk without crutches or sticks, he is deteriorating sadly by the week. I've been told his case will be reconsidered, and yet the Department for Work and Pensions is punitively and callously snatching it from him on the 25th of February. Will the Prime Minister immediately rectify this heartless and disgraceful injustice?
As ever, I'm very happy to look at the individual case that the Right Honourable Gentleman raises. Of course, with the replacement of the disability living allowance with the personal independence payments, actually the most disabled people will be getting more money and more assistance rather than less. But as I say, I'll happily look at the case.
If you believe that, you believe anything. I think that description really highlights the real target that this government has picked on, the most vulnerable, those that cannot stand up for themselves, those that need major support, etc. And if people believe that that is the right way to go, then in the coming elections they can vote for Mr. Cameron. But if anybody's got any compassion for people, then they'll vote anything other than him, because that I think is absolutely appalling. And we've had local cases like that right away throughout Bristol East.
And the other thing, of course, is if you need benefits, say goodbye to privacy. This is an interesting blog post on a blog called Latent Existence, which I've had a look at. And this is on the Social Security Information Sharing in relation to Welfare Services Regulations 2015 have just come into force today. Actually, on that date, anyone claiming universal credit will lose control over who can see their most sensitive personal information. And it's going to be all sorts of your personal information, if you're a benefit claimant, will effectively be shared amongst lots and lots of different agencies. So that's another blow to those who are on benefits. They will be an end to their privacy. Effectively, all their personal details will be getting out and about. Maybe may just have time for a comment from Martin on this whole business of disabled benefits cuts.
Well, it's picking on the weakest and avoiding the fight with the strongest that we need to have.
Which is what sort of fight?
Well, I mean, we need to take on the criminals who are running the banks and the military-industrial complex, and they need to be sent to prison for long terms, never mind cutting their benefits.
OK, Martin, time now for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks to this week's guest, Labour councillor for St George West, Ron Stone. After the Murdoch News, some more on the child sexual abuse inquiry.
An award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.